The final case for oral argument this morning is Larry Mohawk, appellant, v. Kathleen Thompson, appellee. For the appellant, Mr. Gary Timpson, attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellees, Mr. Jack Thieler, an attorney from Mitchell, and Doug Daly, an attorney from Mitchell. And I understand, Mr. Daly, you'll go first for 7 minutes, and then Mr. Thieler for 13. Is that correct, counsel? Very well. Justice Sabres has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Max Gore as the presiding judge of the Sixth Judicial Circuit to act in his place. Mr. Timpson, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. As noted, I'm here on behalf of appellant Larry Mohawk, along with Jennifer Wollman, my associate in this case. Ms. Wollman is ably briefed, though many issues in this case, and so I'm going to try to address my oral argument in the following sequence. I think the critical issue is that of the contributory negligence or not of plaintiff's decedent, Mr. Thompson. If the court, following precedent, gives great weight to the jury verdict and draws all inferences that can be fairly adduced from the evidence in favor of supporting that verdict, why Judgment Murchie's order for new trial is vacated, reversed, and we don't need to get to the other issues. So I'm going to proceed in that regard. I'd like to also maybe have a little bit of a glossary or vocabulary in this case because it's confusing. The right side of the road is the wrong side of the road. This, as the court knows, was a paving project called the Greenwood Project in Charles, Mix County, South Dakota. It was a two-lane asphalt roadway. It had been previously paved, and the contractor, Spencer Quarries, and I'll refer to that as Spencer, was the general contractor laying an asphalt mat on this stretch of road. In doing that, it employed its own trucks, which were semi-dump trailers. The court, I'm sure, is all familiar. We've seen them up and down the road. And also some independent drivers signed on, such as our client, Mr. Mohawk, who was out there on a nod and a handshake. He'd done it before. No written contract and so forth. A couple of types of trailers. Some were end dump trailers, some were belly dump trailers. And the procedure on the project was the semi would load with hot mix or asphalt at the batch plant and then travel down to the end before the paving strip had done, dump the asphalt load in front of the paver, turn around and come back, and then the paver would continue. Where the fresh mat was being laid is known as the hot side. The old or as yet unpaved portion of the roadway, remattled I should say, was known as the cold side. Loaded these trucks weighed about 80,000 pounds, about half that empty. So Spencer Quarries adopted the procedure on its job that the empty trucks were supposed to drive on the cold side. That meant the left side of the roadway. So I'm going to use the terms correct and incorrect as opposed to right and left because in this case the left was right.
Mr. Timpson, I thought they were supposed to drive on the hot side.
The
empty trucks.
You're right. I misspoke. Because of the lesser weight, the empty trucks should drive on the hot or the new mat, and the loaded trucks, because of their greater weight, on the coal side. On the date of this accident, June 16th of 02, Mr. Mohawk's driver, Stan Balser, was loaded. He was traveling in a westerly direction on the south half of the roadway on the cold mat. Mr. Thompson had unloaded, turned around, and had started back eastbound. The dispute is, where was he? The last time any driver saw him, I believe in Mr. Vaughn, he was on the south or cold side. And all trucks had to start there because once they unloaded, they had to turn around on that side. But nobody ever saw him get back onto the north half or hot side of the mat.
How many miles was it from that location where Mr. Vaughn saw him going around the paving machine until the point of the accident?
I believe the whole project was 13 and I believe roughly midpoint, Justice Zitter. So I'm going to say 5 or 6 miles sticks in my mind. And it was on a curve, so you had kind of a parallax view issue there. But basically, the court instructed on contributory negligence of the plaintiff's deceit. The jury heard those instructions, found in favor of the defendant, and awarded nothing. Now, the question, I think, primarily is what, if any, evidence exists in the record to support the jury finding of contributory negligence on the part of plaintiff's decedent? And it is plentiful.
Well, first, let's talk about the duty. What duty do you claim that Thompson violated?
The duty to observe the, quote, rules of the road as imposed on that project. It was mutually understood that an empty truck would be on the hot side and a loaded truck on the cold side. Some of the trucks had CB radios and would communicate if they had to deviate.
But you're saying he was driving on the cold side when he should be on the hot side?
Yes. I think the evidence, I think, tends to support that.
What evidence supports that?
That's what I'm going to catalog, Your Honor. First of all, the drivers, Carr and Baumiller, said it was common practice on the job for even when you were empty to ride on the cold side to minimize wear on the hot side, that it was frequently done. Todd Waldera, the project manager, testified to that as well. So we know that it happened. We know that Vaughn, I believe, the last driver to see Thompson, saw Thompson running eastbound on the cold side. But finally, you get
to the... He had to be on the cold side there because he had to go around the laydown.
That's true, and I acknowledge that in my opening remarks, Judge Gores. But what I'm saying is nobody ever saw him cross back over.
Did anybody ever see him on the hot side or on the cold side after that?
The last anybody saw him, he was on the cold side. So I guess the answer is whatever Mr. Vaughn saw when he turned around and began his return trip empty.
But no testimony is there that he was on the wrong side of the road.
Yes, I think there is, Your Honor.
Who testified?
The trooper Aaron Hansen, who was the investigating officer on the scene. Trooper Michael Selves, who was the is now retired, but was then the reconstructionist for the patrol, and the plaintiff's own hired expert, Daniel Lofgren, who was out there days after this accident, investigated it, interviewed drivers, looked at the physical scene while it was fresh, before the cold side in the accident area had been repaved, etc., and prepared a report in February 2003, which acknowledged that Thompson was on the wrong side, as was customary, and had switched over to the cold side, was switching back over to the hot side when he encountered the Balser vehicle. Let me kind of take those in order. Trooper Hansen said there were 90-some feet of skid marks from the Balser vehicle, indicating that at the onset, he was on the cold or proper side for a loaded truck of the roadway, that he had crossed over. And that based on his experience, the plaintiff called this trooper, and without objection, testified that the only thing and the only explanation for that was that something was in his Balser's way. And I asked him, what was it? And he said, well, it wasn't a deer. The only thing, other thing out there was Mr. Thompson's truck. And so there's testimony there from the physical facts and the investigating officer that Balser had been on the right side. Mr. Laughlin had testified that, as was the practice, the Thompson vehicle was running on the cold side, empty, and had only crossed over when it was approaching or encountering the Balser truck. Because I asked him specifically, he changed his testimony at trial. And I said, well, now wait a minute. You know, here we are, nearly 2 years later. You were the first expert out there to investigate this. You're reporting on behalf of the plaintiff. You finalized your report in February of 2003. We're here at trial in January of 2004. And now for the first time, you say anywhere that Thompson was on the south, or pardon me, was on the north, or hot half of the roadway. What new evidence do you have? Well, he kind of stumbled around. Well, where'd you get that information? Well, Mr. Thieler, a little laughter from the jury. So that was the first time. Their own expert, up until from June of 2002, the date of the accident, until January of 2004, the date of the trial, had maintained that Mr. Thompson was proceeding eastbound on the south or cold map until he made this encounter with the approaching Balser vehicle, which was on the correct side, and apparently looked up both sides. We know from the physical evidence from Stanley Balser's truck that that's where he started and went over and had the collision on the north half or hot half of this right roadway. That's the evidence. Trooper Selves testified. He'd done the diagram.
Oh, there was no eyewitness, was there?
No, well, no surviving eyewitness, Judge.
And in fact, the trooper cells, and everybody in their reports has got Thompson in the proper lane and Balzer crossing into that lane, don't they?
At the time of impact, that's true.
Well, isn't that the relevant time?
Well, no, I don't think it is. I think you have a situation where if you are driving like Mr. Balzer and you see a semi coming straight at you and it's not avoiding, the natural reaction, again, is testified to by both troopers, Hansen and Sells, is to try to avoid. He hit the brakes, and when this guy wasn't taking any evasive action or whatever, he took the last effort to try to avoid. We don't know what went through his mind, but presumably getting onto the hot side was safer than taking the ditch and rolling the rig there. And
that's one of many possible speculations. He could have gone to sleep.
Well, I don't think there's any speculation. I suppose you could speculate that they both had heart attacks. The one was blinded by the sun. But our case, as far as the negligence of the decedent, doesn't rest on speculation. It rests on the fact that the expert that was out there and that the plaintiffs hired said for over a year and a half exactly what we thought after he'd interviewed the people there and seen the physical facts, that Thompson was on the south or coal side of the road immediately prior to impact, and that both vehicles crossed over, you know, near simultaneously and had the collision. Now, the court knows that parties are bound by or cannot claim a version of the facts better than the testimony of themselves or their own witnesses. And there are no surviving eyewitnesses. But again, without objection, Trooper Hansen, who investigated, was out there that day and was interviewing people and taking measurements and doing this sort of thing, said the only explanation is for this 80,000-pound truck will have 90 feet of skid marks and cross over and get on the other side, was that he was avoiding something that was in his proper lane of travel. And again, without objection, without variance or cross-examination or anything else, he said the only thing that could have been in his way and caused him to do that was the Thompson truck. So there is objective evidence, Your Honor, a testimony. Correct, there's no eyewitness testimony. But I think, you know...
And there's no physical evidence that Thompson was in the wrong lane, is there?
Well, the only time he was seen prior to the accident, he was in the wrong lane.
There's no physical evidence like skid marks?
No, there isn't.
No.
No, there isn't. But I guess, you know, my argument is, like the Rogan case, R-O-G-E-N, is cited in our brief, said, and this court has said time and time again, that on issues of contributory negligence, any inferences from the evidence will be drawn in support of the jury verdict. And here, you know, I guess any one of you in this bench can say, boy, I don't think I'd go with Hansen on that, or man, it's obvious the officer made a mistake or whatever. But as this court knows too, that might be your interpretation, weight, or evaluation of the evidence, but it wasn't the jury's. There exists evidence upon which this jury could have found negligence on the part of plaintiff's decedent. And that evidence is the testimony of those people, including the decedent supervisor, Todd Waldera, that these trucks frequently drove on the improper side of the road set up for this project, that the plaintiff's own expert witness in the reconstructionist, in viewing the physical scene and talking to the drivers, made the determination in which he persisted for almost 2 years that Thompson had been on the wrong side of the road, the improper side, immediately prior to impact, and crossed over at about the same time Stanley did. Trooper Hansen's interpretation of the physical evidence stating that the only explanation was that Thompson was on the improper side of the road during impact, concurred in by Trooper Michael Selves, who was the state highway patrol's reconstructionist, who concurred and said that this was an extremely confusing accident and difficult to see what happened. So there is evidence, and the jury interpreted that evidence to support a finding of contributory negligence on the part of plaintiff's decedent. So this court, by its own pronouncement, says, well, we view that evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. The court's function here is not to determine whether it, you collectively, would have reached the same verdict on the same evidence, but whether it's supportable. And when plaintiff calls in an expert that says defendant's theory is right, that's an inference that can support that verdict. So there was this evidence. Now,
but nobody ever said Thompson drove on the wrong side of the road. Did the, in fact, the testimony was that Thompson was the guy that said you gotta drive on the hot side when you're empty. He was the contractor's man that was giving that information out, wasn't he?
I thought Walbera was, but in any event, Judge, the only thing I can say is the last person that saw Thompson saw him on the improper side of the roadway. And to say that he somehow got over there before the accident, that is rank speculation because there is no evidence of that. There is all the evidence I said supporting the inference that until the last minute he was on the improper side of the roadway after Balser began to react. The other thing is, where did this confusion stem from? It stemmed from the fact that Spencer Quarries out there, contrary to established public safety policy, said, loaded on the cold, empty on the hot, you see a farm wagon or a tourist driving through, pull over, and basically see and avoid. We had evidence from our exhibits B, C, and D, as I recall from the brief, that show from the Uniform Manual for Traffic Control Devices and other data that a project of this size and dimension, and this was based on our offer of proof, should have been signed differently and should have had pilot cars running on a project of this size where you're out a visual side one with the other to ensure that there was no intervening traffic for the safety of all concerned, not only what I would call civilian traffic, but for the safety of those workers, both its own employees and independents on the project.
You have pilot cars for truck drivers?
When you have traffic operating beyond sight line on the incorrect side of the road, yes. Or pardon me, I pilot cars or flag people. That's what I meant to say. You should, if somebody flag you there and they have to be in like radio or some other contact with the other side, says stop until you know all the opposite traffic has passed, and then you let this stream go through. We've all experienced the frustration on the hot South Dakota day of sitting in our car with the air conditioner up waiting for that stop sign to turn to a go sign in the hand. And that should have been done. And granted, Spencer Quarries was out of this case by virtue of the exclusivity provisions of its worker comp relationship with the plaintiff's deceased. So it had no further liability. But we argue that we should be able to apportion the negligence between Malhoff, if any, and that of the employer, and having set up this dangerous situation and having failed to follow standard safety guidelines for a project like this, as outlined in our offer of proof. And the court refused to allow us to do that. They did accept our offer of proof, which is part of the record.
Mr. Timpson, what's the problem with seeking contribution under the Joint Tort Feasors Act after the trial? Don't you have that remedy available rather than having the apportionment done during the first trial?
I don't know, and I kind of hate to be here, and I'm not being facetious, in 2 years arguing that in front of you. Why didn't you sue him in the first trial? But having said that, we tried to do that, and I guess the interest of that is probably, that old canard, judicial economy. Why should we have two trials? You don't know you're going to win the first one, and if you did, you wouldn't care about the issue of contribution. But if we have to go back, I think judicial economy and efficiency, administration of justice, fairness of the clients, would all indicate let's decide it all at once. Now, let's not throw it up and see if Mr. Malhoff wins again, and if he doesn't, and we don't have another appeal, then you can come back and see what Spencer Quarries did or did not do in relation to them. I think the judge erred, Judge McMurtry erred in not allowing us to do that. My contention is, given the verdict, which ought to stand, probably now should render that moot, but if this court or three or more of your body disagree and we have to try this again, I think Judge McMurtry ought to be told that we are entitled to apportionment there. The final issue is the exclusion of our expert witness. And I just want to say, we read and hear a lot about comity, civility, and so forth among counsel. I was beyond the discovery deadline because we were mutually operating beyond that. Blame it on me, but the 29 years of practice before this bar, generally when lawyers kind of offer a concession one way, it's deemed to be reciprocal. My mistake, okay? Exclusion is too severe a remedy for my having made that assumption, and I think Judge McMurtry erred. The Magma Hut case and the other cases we cite say that that the exclusion should exist only when there's extreme prejudice to the other party. This was over a month before trial, and, you know, an easier remedy, I guess, would have been a continuance than exclusion, less drastic.
So, why didn't you disclose Alcorn when you hired him in March?
I hadn't had a report from him.
And when you got a report, why didn't you disclose him?
Did when I got the report. Fairly promptly.
After they had moved, a month after they had moved, to exclude any experts because you hadn't disclosed
them. Well, I don't want to go outside the record here about conversations, but let's assume it was my error. Didn't do it last, for the sake of argument. I'm still saying that exclusion is too severe a remedy. Introducing that testimony and allowing it that far in advance of trial would not have prejudiced the plaintiff in any way. And then I guess in a less drastic remedy, you say, okay, we're going to continue this. I don't know how many civil trial cases they try in Charles Mix County a year, but I got to believe in a month or two we could have had another trial date and accommodated everyone. My time for this part's expired, and I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, Mr. Timpson. Mr. Daly, you have 7 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Doug Daly, as indicated earlier, and I'd like to first begin by thanking you for the opportunity to argue this case in front of you all, as this is my first opportunity to do so. I just have to share with the court, something that shows how nervous I am about the fact that I'm arguing for the first time here today, is that when I got here, I realized I left my suit coat at home. So I actually had to borrow a jacket from the Attorney General's office downstairs. Anyway, the issue that I intend to cover here today is the issue with regards to the exclusivity provision of the Workman's Compensation Insurance Act. And as Mr. Timpson did not touch on that particular issue, I will be very brief on that particular issue. And will likely not take up the entire 7 minutes which you have afforded me at this point. At that point, when I'm done, I'll turn it over to Mr. Thieler, who will address the issues covered by Mr. Timpson, and it also will advise you and address the issue with regard to the facts, which we feel were misstated, and we are in disagreement with those regarding the negligence and the evidence presented on that behalf regarding Balzer and Thompson. The issue with regard to the workers' compensation insurance is a question of first impression before this court, and we feel that this would be a good opportunity for this court to address this matter. The particular issue at hand in that matter is whether an employee of a general contractor who receives workman compensation benefits from his employer may bring an action in tort against a subcontractor who's on the particular job. We feel that the answer to that question is yes, that person may bring that action in tort, and that the subcontractor, or Melhoff in this particular instance, is some other person who is amenable to suit as contemplated by SDCL 62-2-38. The crux of our argument in that particular issue is that there is no quid pro quo. In other words, because Melhoff had no liability with regard to the no-fault provisions of the workers' compensation insurance and did not have to provide any coverage for the employee of either the general contractor or someone higher up, therefore he has no expectation of immunity from suit by those particular employees as well. We're asking this court to go down the path followed by the majority of the cases, the majority of the states that says that there is immunity up the ladder for people, those that are higher up in the hierarchy of the contractor subcontractor status, based upon the fact that they play a backup quarterback role. They are paid to sit on the bench to provide backup in case the employer doesn't provide workman's compensation insurance or benefits to their employee. Therefore, because they are on the bench, they should also be afforded the immunity. Whereas the reverse is not true. The majority of jurisdictions do not allow immunity to go down the ladder the other way, which is what is being requested by the appellant in this particular matter for this court to follow. It basically just doesn't follow the rationale that our courts have found or held in South Dakota regarding the issue of immunity for responsibility, as set forth in the Metzger case, which indicates that the principal or subcontractor is not some other third person, as anticipated by the statute, because they provide this insurance. Our courts have held that that quid pro quo is at the basis of our workman's compensation statute and does not work in the reverse because of the lack of, I guess, responsibility on the part of the subcontractor. So we would urge this court to address that issue, as we do feel that we will be, I guess, successful on our other issues, specifically with regard to the contributory negligence issue, to provide this court the opportunity to address this issue and find that immunity does not go down the ladder as being requested by the appellant. With that said, unless there are questions, I would, I guess, turn the matter over to Mr. Thieler and to give him the balance of my time.
Thank you. No one's ever chastised for quitting early.
Thank you.
Mr. Thieler, you have 13 minutes, sir.
Okay. May it please the court, I want to clear up a couple parts of the record, and repeatedly at trial, at times on the record even, Judge McMurtry had to address defense counsel for misstatement of the record, and we're still there. Several miles from the west end Greenwood to where the accident occurred, and it's on page 32 of our brief, trial transcript 275, Martin Magstead, in this several miles, as Terry Thompson is coming back east, he's passing trucks that are going west. There's a truck every, sometimes more than a truck in a mile. Merlin Magstead, who was called to testify, testified that he was the last person to pass Terry Thompson, and Terry Thompson was on the hot on the other side of the road. And it was Mr. Vaughn who said he saw him back there, and Judge Gores was asking counsel of that. When you went up to the paver, you dumped into the paver from the cold side. And Terry Thompson and the eyewitnesses were all consistent. Terry Thompson, no one ever saw Terry Thompson drive on the wrong side of the road. It has to do some with this muddled record of when you get into the contributory negligence of the employer, this unsafe work site, and that's what the, you know, issues 3 and 5 in our brief. And the answer to Justice Zinter is the employer cannot be held for contribution because the exclusivity of the workman's comp. So they would not be a proper party in the lawsuit. You can ask the court to address, allow you to address the contributory negligence of the employer to apportion and reduce, but only, as the court has said in Parker v. Casa del Rey in 2002, if there's evidence that supports the conclusion that it's the sole and proximate and only cause of the accident was the employer. And that's not the issue. Let's talk about the facts. Exhibit 65 and 65A, as Mr. Lofgren set them out, it's the overlay and it's the map of the road. And they were coming into a curve, and we have this truck with all these tires, and these experts all testified, and you just heard the version, and I would certainly urge you and your clerks to read carefully the testimony, as I know you will, of Hansen, Sells, and Lofgren. They didn't testify, as Mr. Timpson has just said. In cross-examination, for instance, Hansen, over objection, got into the human factors, kind of speculating, saying, well, one thing could be something else is on the other side of the road. Nobody knew there was a deer there, and nobody testified that there wasn't a deer there, but he just said that, speculation-wise, over objection, that there could be something on the other side of the road. All the evidence is consistent that Terry Thompson and all his wheels on his trailer and his tractor, and he's going straight in his lane of traffic like this. And the evidence is that Mr. Balzer started skidding just as he got to the center line and all the skidding was after he was in Terry's lane. And the experts testified that if you would have tried to move Terry Thompson's vehicle suddenly down for Mr. Baltzer to be suddenly coming over, it would have left marks. So the judicial standard of review on this, the court granting new trial and the judgment notwithstanding the verdict, is they have to show a clear abuse of discretion on the judge's part, that no judicial mind could have reached the same conclusion. And Judge McMurtry, from the time we made the motion, tried to exclude the contributory negligence issue on the record, said I shouldn't give it to the jury. There is no evidence of contributory negligence of Terry Thompson.
But he did give it.
But he gave it. But there is no support of it. And as this court said in 2003 in Johnson v. Armfield, is you said, in fact, there, it was the same thing, that a defendant had a bare assertion that there was contributory negligence. And the court had to speculate as to why the jury returned a zero verdict. We have a special interrogatory that says they found Terry Thompson negligent. Contributory, more than slight. No, so all it was bare assertions. And we tried the case, and Judge McMurtry heard it for the 4 days and came down to the same conclusion, but, and in fact, we said it on the record, well, I'll just give it to the jury and see what happens. And trial judges properly do that. And that's where this issue of why Spencer Quarries, Commercial Asphalt, it's one and the same, two different corporations, same employer, these unsafe work rules, which really there wasn't anything unsafe, they always drive on these projects. They drive for days on these projects, to include the Melhoff drivers, and the Melhoff drivers understood the rules. But good defense lawyers like Mr. Timpson get a confused set of facts, and they got a jury to say there was contributory negligence, yet there's no evidence, and the defense has the burden of that.
Mr. Thieler, aren't you in a dilemma? The directed verdict motion basically is premised on the fact that no reasonable jury could find contributory negligence. And yet you're very happy with the jury's reasonable decision to find negligence. Are they unreasonable at one time and reasonable at the other?
Well, to say that, was there any evidence to support the jury's finding of negligence when three experts, two of which were there from day one in investigating it, Selves and Hansen, and all the physical facts and all the pictures say that one vehicle came totally across and smashed into the other. So I don't think there's any, one, we move for a directed verdict just plain on liability. But the judge gave that to the jury, and the jury found them negligent, or they wouldn't have got the contributory. They didn't spend 1 minute in final argument trying to say that Mr. Magstead did nothing wrong. So I don't think I have any problem. Pardon, Mr. Baltzer. I'm sorry. I don't have any problem accepting the fact of the negligence, and no one's even arguing it in the brief, that Mr. Baltzer, Melhoff's employee, wasn't negligent.
So they were reasonable then?
They were. They were. And I don't think it's the jury standard of review we're looking at. We're looking at a trained judge that heard all the exact same evidence and looked at exactly what the jury did and said, so is there no judicial mind that could have found from the fact that no one said Terry Thompson did one thing wrong but bare assertions? And the bare assertions were always confusing work site. And that's why we tried to keep that evidence out, and the judge let it in. And so it's a smokescreen. But I'd like to talk about this expert witness issue. And
before you get to that, though, on the confusing work site, I mean, the jury had to know. You had to tell the jury about the unusual rules of the road that were.
Yeah, and all the witnesses testified, and it wasn't unusual because they worked for years on hot, cold projects exactly the same. Keep in mind, the hot side and the cold side isn't necessarily always the wrong side.
So is it Mr. Timpson right? I mean, the door was opened on that.
Well, the door was open, except they tried to. No one testified that Commercial Asphalt has a confusing work site. In fact, they brought in a witness that said he rides the water truck, never drove a dump truck, and he was the only one that seemed to question which you should go back and forth. They said there's evidence that sometimes people drove on the other side, but no one could see one truck and name one driver that did on this project. So I don't think there was a confusing work site. OSHA didn't think so either, because they found no job work site problems. So yes, the jury had to know exactly where they were driving and why.
Why shouldn't they know all the rules then?
Well, they did. They heard the whole works. They heard everything about Spencer Court and the work site, and there wasn't any restriction, and the court allowed all that testimony.
Except for the, what is it, this?
Standards of review.
Standards of some body, some
specific. It's the Manual of Uniform Traffic Safety, and in that would have been issues concerning pilot cars that would have applied only in the event of a pedestrian coming in. And it would have nothing to do. There's no pedestrian car here. So you actually get the standards with Spencer Quarry's liability not being an issue, because they're not the sole and proximate. We're back to Castle Del Rey. And so, but they got the best of the all worlds. They got to beat on Spencer Quarry's the whole time. And really never said Terry Thompson did one thing wrong. And final argument with Spencer Quarry's. And so now you got a jury that could get confused when you get to contributory negligence, because the lawyer spent 4 days telling them that something was wrong on this project. Terry Thompson's negligence is measured. And the judge properly, in granting the motion, said there's not one scintilla of evidence against Terry Thompson. Let's go to Mr. Elkhorn, because the civility, apparently I'm the only non-civil lawyer out there. The accident wasn't in 2002, as Mr. Timpson kept saying. The accident was in June of 2000. And the complaint was in October of 2001, with all the information to the insurance company and the employer and so on, long before that. Discovery started in June of 2002, and we asked them about experts and reports. The scheduling order by stipulation, correction, discovery was January 2002. The scheduling order by stipulation was January of 2003. The defendant's disclosures were due March 17th, 2003. And there was absolutely no issue of trials in January. On November 7th, we got their report, which was 3 weeks and more after we had just, after the deadline, to file your in limine motions. And everybody's witnesses are lined up, and we had all, so now we're June of 2000, and Mr. Elkhorn's report refers to the hearsay testimony of Lou Dirks, a reconstructionist from the Sioux Falls area that was on site in June of 2000, and issued a report to the defendant's company. And Mr. Elkhorn coming in, it's just a ruse, was apparently going to try, based on the hearsay, we never saw the Lou Dirks report. So what we said to the trial judge in November is, if we were going to do this, all of a sudden, gentlemen, take a deposition at the last minute, we were going to start over, because there was reference to hearsay from multiple people. And Mr. Elkhorn, if in fact they had any evidence, Lou Dirks was there in January of 2000 and told him exactly what he thought happened. Mr. Hansen was there in January of 2000. Mr. Sells was there, both troopers at the time. And all that information, the defendant employer had going towards a disclosure in November 2003. And our court has said in Schrader Charts in 1994, you've got to have an excuse. If it's just willful neglect, and there's no other reason. So why would a company come up? I wouldn't be very proud of Mr. Elkhorn's report anyway, because Mr. Elkhorn was going to, he said that Terry Thompson was in the wrong lane of traffic, and that Mr. Balzer was in the right lane of traffic, and it was all Terry's fault. Contrary to all physical facts, all experts, to include, I assume, Mr. Dirks, they would have disclosed him years before. So that's the civility, and I'm a little sharp on that one. I think I have a lot of civility, but I don't give up my client's January trial for the wrongful death of their father and the wrongful death of their husband.
Well, let's get by that, though, because the question is whether the ultimate sanction under Rule 37 should be should be utilized right out of the box. And I think we've all seen the trial judge's letter where he gave his reason for his ruling on that. In fact, I think we saw that on maybe a request for intermediate, because I know I've read that letter before. It struck me.
You're talking about, in this case, a request for intermediate. I think there was a request for intermediate, and it got denied. And defense will have to remind me. But let's go to Schrader and say, what is the standard?
Your time has expired a long time ago.
I'll allow
this question. Please keep the answer brief.
Okay. You go to Jarks v. Schrader and say, you have to say why you didn't. And in fact, Schrader, Jarks, says you then have to show how you would have gotten a different result. Well, they got the result they wanted. They got the jury to buy that Spencer Corey's had a confused work site. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Mr. Timpson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I thank you, Chief Justice, Justices. Well, you know, the jury heard a disputed version of the facts, and I guess you folks have now, too. He's right. The accident was in 2000. And if he'll give me the fact that my brief had it right, my argument folks had it wrong, and I apologize. And if he'll forgive me for that, I'll forgive him for talking about pedestrian cars. What I want to say on the workers' comp thing that Mr. Daly addressed, I think that's been ably briefed. I would say only this. It's true that South Dakota jurisprudence talks about a downstream effect. The only reason for that is because the Metzger case was a downstream case. It talked about a third party other than one being generally engaged in the work. If Midwest Coast Transport was hauling a load of beef down this highway and was involved in the accident, that would be an outside party. In this case, you have both sides covered by workers' compensation. Both Stan Balser was covered by the Melhoff policy and Terry Thompson by the Spencer Quarries policy. So I think that's clear, but it's adequately addressed in our brief, and unless there are questions, I'll move back on what I think is the critical issue.
The only question I have on that, you concede you want us to adopt the minority rule.
Yes, I think the reason is because the context in which it normally arises, as it did in the Metzger versus Bronken case, is usually an upstream type case. I think it's a minority opinion, because there's more cases that involve the Metzger analysis than the other ones, not because there's any jurisprudential reason that it shouldn't apply equally both ways when you're dealing with two employees on the same project of different employers, both of whom are protected by the benefits of the workers' compensation statutes, Your Honor. Now, let's just look at Mr. Magstad. Yeah, he said the last time I saw Terry Thompson, he was on the north half of the roadway. That was about a mile from the paver. Right, we know that Vaughn saw him on the south half. And the reason for that is very easily explained, and it's explained by Mr. Loftman in his written report, where Mr. Loftman said in his written report, which he persisted in July of 2000 until January of 2004. And he says, and I'll quote from page 237 of the transcript, in which I was quoting directly, verbatim from his report, quote, the empty truck would shift to the left into the oncoming lane while the loaded rig would stay in the left lane and the two passed each other. He said, and he found that that's what happened in this case. Terry Thompson was empty and right down pole side. And when he saw Max Daddy, he crossed over and then got back. And when he saw, apparently too late, Balser, and Balser's kidding, he tried to do the same thing again. Now, that is not confusion. That's not my misstatement of the facts. That's saying you went out, hired this guy.
Would you please, we're on the internet here. You got to stick close to the
All point. Right, I'm sorry, Mr. Chief Justice. This accident reconstructionist, and brought him into court with darn near 4 years of opinion behind him, saying exactly what we said happened, that the physical facts, and buttressed by Sells and Hansen, are that Thompson was on the south half or improper side of the roadway, and both of these trucks, in a tragic misjudgment, tried to, at the last minute, avoid a collision by doing the same thing, and it was a mirror image thing. Again, I don't know if that's a version, if any one of the five of you were sitting in that jury box down in Lake Andes would have believed, but it's a believable version, and 12 people believed it, the panel, I don't know if it was 11-1 or 10-2 or what it was, but the jury believed it. And listening to all the evidence, Judge McMurtry sitting there in the dynamics of the trial and hearing the argument,